Hello, I'm Rob Reifert. This is number 0374, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0374. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet comedian Rich Scheidner, who talks about his new book, Kicking Through the Ashes. Where did the book's title come from?
You know, whenever I see on the news somebody's house is burned down, you know, behind the camera crew and the reporter, you'll see some guy or some woman just kind of kicking through the ashes trying to find something of value. And I felt like, metaphorically, that house is my career, my time in stand-up comedy, and I'm just trying to find something of value when I started this book.
Franchise expert Tom Skarda on the one-year success of McDonald's all-day breakfast.
McDonald's was slow in doing this. I don't know why they didn't do it 20 years ago, but I actually do know why. There's just way too much equipment, and it was too much to mandate the franchise owners to kind of switch over. But then they saw a drop in their traffic in their stores because of a lot of different reasons. But one thing is gourmet hamburger places like Five Guys. And Mr. Easterbrook, who is the now CEO of McDonald's, decided to do this all-day breakfast menu, and it worked phenomenally well.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. He also hits on the thorny issue of talkative taxi drivers.
I don't start to talk to them unless they bring the subject up. And when they bring the subject up, I don't give them any shtick. I don't tell them jokes. I don't do a performance. I would just discuss it in a normal kind of situation, not be a wise guy like I am with you. My advice to young cab drivers, and I teach a lot of them how to make the maximum amount of money, those are the magic words, though. The idea is to make money, not to make friends. It's to shut up and just drive.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0374 was voiceover artist and broadcaster Rob Reifert, who was also a former co-worker of mine back in the day. Thank you very much, Rob, for doing the guest late on this program. Nice to hear from you once again. By the way, you can check out his website at robreiford.com, and Reiford is spelled W-R-E-F-O-R-D. That's robreiford.com. Check him out. Thank you very much, Rob, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, it's quite popular to talk about the weirdness that seems to always take place in the state of Florida. It might give one the impression that perhaps there is something, oh, I don't know, in the water there. However, it's not only those who are weird who are already in the Sunshine State, but the fact that the state seems to attract weirdness from other states. Case in point, 70-year-old Robert Hugh Shearer of Dayton, Ohio, decided to move to The Villages, which is a sprawling retirement community in Florida. He packed up a truck with his belongings and had a friend from church drive it to Florida with his wife in the passenger seat while Shearer rode his motorcycle following along. On Interstate 75 near Lake Panasoffkee, Shearer couldn't keep up with the truck and got upset. He called his wife from his cell phone and demanded they stop, which they did at a convenience store. There, Shearer and his church friend argued, and Shearer allegedly shot out a tire on the truck. A store clerk called 911. Shearer was arrested on charges of improperly firing a weapon, improperly exhibiting a firearm, and criminal mischief. When the investigating sheriff deputy confiscated Shearer's Colt 1911 pistol, he told him the procedure for getting it back. "Yeah," Shearer replied. "Last time it took 7 years to get it back." Yeah, he'll fit right in Florida, won't he? And the question is, back in Ohio, I know it took 7 years to get his gun back, but why did he get it back? And why was it taken away in the first place? That's what I want to know. But yeah, he'll fit right in Florida. Plainfield, Connecticut police were called to a convenience store where employees said a man had spent 40 minutes attempting to make a milkshake. Wow. Little syrup, little ice cream, little milk. 40 minutes? I don't know. Officers found 47-year-old Gina Minot slumped against the wall outside and 37-year-old Randy Vallade nodding off in the store's chill zone, a frozen drink still in his hand. Police searched both of them and say they found numerous bags of heroin. Both were arrested on drug charges and released on bond. Oh, I'm sure after their trial, they'll spend more time in the cooler. And while other vehicle safety control engineers work on actually slowing down cars and buses when a risk is detected on the road ahead, one of Volvo's recent innovations appears aimed merely at bullying pedestrians to get out of the way. According to a September report on treehugger.com, the safety control for a Volvo bus consists of progressively louder horn honking to scare off the pedestrian. Well, if you don't kill them by running them over, the heart attack should take them out, huh? Yeah. And we have a couple of rather interesting police blotter items that feature a certain amount of, shall we say, whimsy. Number one, the long rap sheet of Darian Clinton, who was 48, reared its ugly head once again. He was in the process, according to Minneapolis police, of burglarizing a hotel room in September when an occupant returned and surprised him. Clinton, wielding a knife, escaped momentarily, but the occupant summoned his nearby roommates, the visiting University of Arizona men's cross-country team, and after a chase, which included jumping several barriers, the runners steered a severely winded Clinton into the arms of a state trooper. Hey, if you're going to commit a crime, at least be in shape for it. And number two, 52-year-old Kerry Johnson was arrested in August in Charleston, West Virginia, and charged with robbing a City National Bank branch. Police said Johnson had been gambling at the Mardi Gras casino in nearby Nitro when he ran out of money at the blackjack table. He left a $25 chip to preserve his spot, excused himself, went to the bank, and then came back with more money. Well, he's busted now in more ways than one, isn't he? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, based on recent convictions for indecent exposure, 50-year-old Anthony Hardison has a public masturbation habit, and it is apparently so bad that he engaged once again in August while he was in the lobby of the sheriff's office in Seattle, where he had reported to register as a sex offender. Needless to say, he was arrested. Okay, whose unhealthy job is it to fingerprint that guy? No, I'm not doing it. No, I'm not doing it. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program this week, shall we? The 1980s saw an explosion of stand-up comedy, and Rich Scheidner was at ground zero with other young comics such as Jay Leno, Jerry Seinfeld, Roseanne Barr, and Tim Allen, just to name a few. Now he has written a book sharing his experiences during those wild times called Kicking Through the Ashes. Rich joins us right now on the line from a cruise ship somewhere near Halifax. Hi, Rich.
Good. How you doing, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Your book is called, as I said, Kicking Through the Ashes. What's the meaning behind that title?
You know, whenever I see on the news somebody's house is burned down, you know, behind the camera crew and the reporter, you'll see some guy or some woman just kind of kicking through the ashes trying to find something of value. And I felt like, metaphorically, that house is my career, my time in stand-up comedy at that era. And I'm just trying to find something of value when I started this book. And then it sort of led me from where I was trying to write a book on the history of stand-up comedy. Phyllis Diller wanted me to do that, and we talked about it. And then I went, it's too much. It was reading like a textbook. And I thought, let me just tell my stories of the 80s and try to get a book down about the 1980s. So I talked to a lot of people who were there then to get the history of it. And so I got the history of it and sort of my journey through it and just try to cover every angle of stand-up.
Mm. Was stand-up really in your blood? Was it something you had to do?
Yes, really. This just came out since I finished the book. My brother has a picture. In the picture, my two brothers, my sister, my mom, my aunt, and I are staring at the camera. Everybody's laughing but me. So I'm standing there with my mom and my brother, and he got the picture. And I said, "Well, how come I'm not laughing?" And my brother said, "Because you probably cracked a joke." And I was about 15. And then my mom says, "Thank God you were funny." And then later my mom and I are talking, and she was like, "You know, your job was to make me laugh. That's what you did from the early stage. I mean, that was my job, to make she for all the reasons that aren't in the book, but for her reasons, you know, she needed to laugh, and that was my job." Mm. So yeah, it was in my blood.
But even though it was your job, as your mother would say, how did your parents feel when you said, "You know, I'm going into show business, folks"?
Yeah, she did. She didn't have that in her mind back then. I tell you, she didn't. No, not back in 1979 when I said I was not going to be a lawyer and leaving law school and went to New York City to do comedy. No, she screamed. My stoic, quiet mother screamed, and my dad, who was the loud sort of loud guy, he just slumped in his chair. He kind of looked like Oswald when he got shot by Ruby. He just was gut shot in a chair, and no, she didn't approve of it. No.
So you were in law school. There had to be this leap of faith on your part where you said, you know, I can't do this. I've got to follow my dream. Was that a difficult process for you?
You know, yeah, sure it was. I don't think I ever had that sort of elevated thought process you just described. I just knew I had to do it. It wasn't even a choice. It wasn't a choice. There were these guys, these men and women up in New York City doing it then. I had discovered them. And I said, "I got to go there. I got to do it." I sort of found my tribe, and I just was like, "No, I got to do this." It wasn't a choice. It really wasn't.
How did you go about developing the persona you had on stage? And the reason why I bring that up is the one thing I've always enjoyed about your stand-up is there's this energy that you have on stage, like somebody who comes out and says, "You know, I really got to tell you the story." And you draw people in just by that energy. So how did that develop for you?
Yeah, you know, when I first started, I was like influenced by everybody I'd seen. You know, Albert Brooks, Robert Klein, Carlin, Pryor, everybody. So I was a mishmash of all these styles, and I had to strip them away. Every time I'd do something on stage and I thought to myself, "That was Klein or whatever, I'm not going to do that again." And I remember my buddies, when they saw me about... in 1981, I've been doing about 4 years, and they'd seen me earlier, you know, a couple of years before that, and then they came up to me about 81, they went, "You know, Rich, you're really funny, man. I mean, we saw you before, you were funny, but you weren't you, and now you're really you. You're the guy who we remember from the bars, and that's how you were then. You're like that now." I'd stripped everything away and just was like, what was funny about me, I was doing that. And as far as the energy, I always felt like I didn't have any performing skills. Like I could write. I had a mind for comedy, but I didn't feel like I had any performing skills. And because I was a bad athlete, but I was an athlete when I was younger. I always approached the stand up not like in a theatrical way. I approached it like an athletic event. I was just up there, just going to go out as hard as I could, and sort of will them to my side.
You have had an opportunity to also to be on camera as an actor. You played Al Bundy's co-worker in Married with Children. You also had, I believe, several pilots, as a lot of comics had, through the years for television shows. And you've done some other acting as well. I'm just curious to know your thoughts about stand-up itself, because I know that there's a lot of stand-ups who go into acting and never go back to stand-up, but here you are, you're doing stand-up, and that's a kind of a dying breed, isn't it?
Yeah, that happens, and I've seen people give up their stand-up franchises. They get a sitcom, they become stars, and they drop it, but I always admired him, like Jerry Seinfeld. I felt like he was a stand-up first and foremost and always, and if he had never become the iconic superstar from the sitcom Seinfeld, he would still be doing stand-up. I mean, he was going to do it. That's all there is to it. And never, that's where, look, I didn't get into it to become an actor. I didn't get into it to become rich and famous, and that's worked out real well. That's been, like, I've met my goal. But I always felt like I just wanted to do it for the laughs. I wanted to do it for the, that was my music, the sound of laughter. So, I mean, I got away from it for a while. I lost sight of that for a while, and it led me to a Great Depression. But when I got back to it, through I Am Comic with Jordan Brady, that documentary we did, I got back to starting to stand up again, and I hear the music. I hear it. I love it. I love the laughter.
Now, you had stepped away from it for about 15 years, is that right?
Yeah, it was about 13 years, something like that, about 13 years, something like that. Yeah.
So was it difficult to get back into, or is it, as the old saying goes, like riding a bike?
That's right. Yeah, it was very difficult. If it was like riding a bike, I was wobbly and crashing for a while. You know, it was flabby. It's a muscle. It's a whatever it is. I was completely out of shape. I had to build a new act. I felt like I had to do new material that reflected where I was now and not where I was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And so I had to build this act, and I had to go do all these open mic nights and things around L.A. And, you know, open mic nights now are just comics performing for comics. It's the amount of comics now outnumber the amount of available audience members. It's that wild in terms of... So I had to do it in these places. I had to do it, and I had to keep doing it, and you know, build an act back up, a new act, and my stage strength or whatever it is.
In this day and age, modern days, the social media, the 21st century, are audiences different? Is comedy different than back in the heydays of the 80s?
Well, yeah, it's way different. Everything's different. Everything changes. The comedic language changes. And we were big on sarcasm and satire, and now they're a big on irony and parody. I mean, even the language the comics use changes, and the audience changes. I mean, like, I hit it the right wave. I hit it. We were like little rock stars going around. The places were packed. You didn't have to have a name. They showed up for the comedy, and you were that guy that night. Now, see, you got to have a draw. If you're not a draw, you know, you're just one of the many squirming worms in a bucket, and the club would just put you on the hook that night and throws you out there. There's no, you know, the audiences are, if you don't have them every second, they're on their cell phone, they're texting, they're, what else is going on someplace else if you don't have them? Attention span is less. And if you can't draw, if you can't require them to have a ticket price, I always love what a cover charge does to an attention span. I mean, if they don't pay anything to get in, they have nothing invested in the show, they're likely to not pay attention at all.
Who did you write your book for, Kicking Through the Ashes? Was it for Rich Scheidner fans out there, people who want to get into comedy and want to know what it's like to do it, or just those who like the history of the profession itself? Who's your core audience, you see?
I wrote it for my kids. I wrote it for the peers, the people who went through this with me. You know, I thought they would enjoy it. It really matters to me what they think of it. And, yeah, anybody younger who's thinking about doing it, I wanted them to go, this is what it is. This is what being a stand-up is. I read Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up, which I think was the best book ever written about stand-up comedy. And I wanted to be something on that level where I kind of covered everything. I wanted to be something where people got an idea what it was to do stand-up comedy. But, I guess I wrote it for... So my kids read it, and they were like, okay, now we understand you a little better, Dad. I think that was important to me.
That's great. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you're on a cruise ship somewhere near Halifax. It's one of the interesting things to be a performer on a ship, because unlike performing other places, you do your show, you walk off stage, you go home or whatever the case may be, but you get to, you're a captive audience along with everyone else on the ship. They can walk up to you after the show and hang out with you. What's that like as a comic to see your audience after you performed?
Yeah, I'm a ghost on this ship, man. When I do go out of my cabin, I'm like Michael Jackson dressed. You know, I got so many disguises. I don't know. You know, this is my circling the drain tour, and this is where the people my age are now. They're on cruise ships and country clubs, and they do these things a lot, and I'm fine with it. I like it. Look, I don't have any illusions. I mean, it's not like I'm a draw. I love when comics go, you know, I got another packed house here on the cruise ship. I go, come on. Their choice is coming to see you or staring at open water. You know, you're not really drawing. Nobody's paying to get in to see me, but I enjoy them. I like it. I like to hear the people laugh.
Also, and then we're just running out of time, but I got to bring this up too. I mean, you also had an amazing career as a comedy writer. You've written on sitcoms like Roseanne, the Jeff Foxworthy show, and several others. And I'm just wondering, how does being a comedy writer, well, actually, is it a chicken or egg kind of thing? Was being a stand-up helpful to being a comedy writer, or does being a comedy writer really help your stand-up down the road? How does that work?
I think you hit it. I think it's both. I used to think it was sort of like they're separate engines altogether. I always felt like I was a better writer than a performer. But I also realized that when I performed, I got better as a writer, and when I wrote, I got better as a performer. And so they're really both the same. But I think most people feel like they're better than one than the other. When I write, I stand up better. And when I perform, I get a better idea of what works as a writer. So it's linked. That's the two things you have to be as a stand-up. You don't have to be. You can buy material. You have to be a performer. It's a performance art. But for me, I have to do those two things. Because if I write it, nobody reads it. What does it matter?
The book is called Kicking Through the Ashes. It's written by Rich Heidner. Rich, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Again, I know you're at sea, so it's a little difficult to correspond and get together. But I thank you for being on the show, sir.
Thanks, Peter. You've been a great host. Thank you, man. Thank you.
Comic Rich Heidner. His book is Kicking Through the Ashes. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0374, and you'll find links to Rich's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about McDonald's all-day breakfast. It's been a year since they started that in the United States, and it's been quite the success. Plus, Peter Franklin the Gabby Cabby shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge, and we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Plus, a lot more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Portuguese immigrant who recently arrived in Philadelphia went to a drive-up ATM. He doesn't speak English, but he grasped the meaning of the gun a robber stuck in his face. The unnamed immigrant drove off, but later returned in hopes of recovering his debit card, which he had left at the ATM when he fled. Police say the attacker was still there and pounced again. So the immigrant rammed into him, went through the fallen robber's pockets, and retrieved his money and card. Police, who found the 49-year-old robber in the street, says he will be charged when he gets out of the hospital, and the driver, barring new evidence, will not be. Well, he hasn't learned English, but he's already contributing to the country, isn't he? Yes. And 35-year-old Gideon Hodge was at work when his fiancée called to say his Broodmoor, Louisiana apartment building was on fire. It had spread from the house next door. Hodge rushed home, ran past the firefighters, who were yelling at him to stop, and dashed inside. An aspiring actor and writer, Hodge had two completed novels on his laptop, and only on his laptop. Anybody that's ever created art, there's no replacing it, Hodge said after successfully retrieving his computer. It's got pretty much my life's work. Yeah, seems reasonable. I believe this is what's called potentially dying for your art. Question is, if you can't save it, and were dumb enough not to have a backup, does that mean you're dumb enough to want to die for it? Inquiring minds want to know. Was he writing a mystery or a comedy? That's also what I like to know. Anyway, a Cumberland, Maine police officer noticed a car with its license plate light out. When the officer tried to pull the car over, the driver, 21-year-old Anthony Lane, initially complied, but according to police, then sped off when the officer got out of his vehicle. A high-speed chase followed, allegedly reaching speeds of 100 miles per hour. The chase ended when Lane failed to negotiate a turn and plowed the vehicle that he was driving, which, by the way, was his mother's car, into three parked cars, which in turn damaged a building. Lane was arrested and charged with eluding an officer, criminal speeding, driving to endanger, and, oh, wait a minute, operating without a license. Yeah, they never have a license in these stories, do they? He was released after posting bail. Well, sure, they let him out. He still has to face his mother. Yeah. And severe storms led to flooding in Connellsville, Pennsylvania. A wall held the waters back from the Connellsville Church of God until it collapsed and mud and water filled the church's basement. The devastation on our whole church is unreal, lamented the Reverend Nelson Confer. The good news is the building is insured by Church Mutual Insurance. The bad news is the insurance company told Confer that the flooding damage isn't covered because it was, yes, an act of God. The parishioners giveth and the fine print taketh away, doesn't it? And police in Poland shared body camera footage of the search for a theft suspect that ended with him being found hiding inside a dishwasher. Glogau police said officers went to arrest the 30-year-old man at his apartment on allegations including stealing a car, a motorcycle, and a bicycle. Well, clearly he likes modes of transportation, doesn't he? Police said the man did not answer his door and was seen jumping from his second floor and apartment and entering a first-floor apartment through a window. Body camera footage from the police search of the otherwise unoccupied residence shows an officer opening the dishwasher, revealing the hand of the man hiding inside the appliance. The suspect was arrested and faces additional property damage charges as a result of breaking into the apartment, police said. Well, if he can fit into a dishwasher, he's going to find a jail cell extremely spacious, isn't he? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In September, an unnamed woman was detained at the airport in Graz, Austria, because her suitcase held two plastic containers with her late husband's intestines inside. She had come from Morocco seeking doctors' opinions whether he had been poisoned, but doctors told local media they would have to examine the entire body to determine that. Police said no laws had been broken. Well, not yet. Wait until she returns with the entire body. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Last week was the one-year anniversary of the McDonald's all-day breakfast menu in the United States, and stats show it is a success. What makes it so? We put that question to franchise expert Tom Skarda. He's the author of Franchise Savvy, 6 Strategies Pros Use to Pick Top-Performing Franchises. Tom joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So it's been a success for McDonald's. And by the way, we should mention, I'm in Canada where we do not have all-day McDonald's breakfasts, at least yet. But it's been a success in the United States. It kind of makes you wonder, Why did people wait so long? I mean, you'd think that people would want breakfast when they want breakfast.
Yeah. Well, you know, breakfast is like a comfort food. I know for me, I love breakfast more than any other meal. And I think, you know, I don't know if you've ever gone into a McDonald's at, you know, 11:15 in the morning and they're not serving breakfast anymore. It's such a letdown. There's probably nothing worse during the day than for that to happen to you. You know, McDonald's was slow in doing this. I don't know why they didn't do it 20 years ago, but well, I actually do know why. There's just way too much equipment, and it was too much to mandate the franchise owners to kind of switch over. But then they saw a drop in their traffic in their stores because of a lot of different reasons. But one thing is gourmet hamburger places like Five Guys. And Mr. Easterbrook, who is the now CEO of McDonald's, decided to do this all-day breakfast menu, and it worked phenomenally well.
Now, how has that affected their most direct competitors?
Well, Dunkin' Donuts here in the United States dropped 0.8% in revenues in the first quarter when they did this. Now they're coming back and offering a lot more menu items for breakfast at Dunkin' Donuts. And about 4 months ago, Taco Bell has started doing breakfast. Not such a grand stand ovation like McDonald's got when they did their breakfast, but they're doing some quesadilla breakfast things over at Taco Bell and trying to, you know, put their hat in the ring as well.
As you mentioned, this is probably something McDonald's should have done 20 years ago. Is this a situation where McDonald's just came to the conclusion that breakfast all day was a good thing, or were they actually listening to what customers wanted? Or were they aware of the fact that customers wanted breakfast beyond 11 a.m.?
I think they were very aware of it, but I think they were, you know, had hamburger on the brain. I mean, they were doing hamburgers, and they were doing well at it. And in 2009, they did roll out their coffees. I mean, they always had coffee, and it was kind of an insider coffee lover's secret that McDonald's always had good coffee. But then they brought it to the forefront of their stores. And now they're even doing McCafés. Even in Canada, they're opening up these McCafés, which are standalone breakfast-type quick spots for McDonald's. I think that they took a shot at doing breakfast in order to get their revenues up again and satisfy the stockholders, because their revenues have been dropping with the gourmet burgers like Five Guys and BurgerFi and a whole bunch of different locations all over the world, actually.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the coffee and the unknown secret, I guess, or the well-known secret that their coffee was probably mm-hmm. pretty good. Do you think, and I'm not just talking about McDonald's now here, do you think that franchises are sometimes unaware or unwilling to promote what they do best that might not be to the forefront of their product line, like in this case, McDonald's coffee?
Yeah, I think what they don't want to do is remind people of why they're not going to the store to begin with. So it becomes a very kind of gingerly, you know, marketing campaign on how they're going to tell people, hey, we got this great thing, but it's not what we're known for, which kind of underlies, like, is what you're known for not good anymore? That's the problem they run into.
Now, I mentioned your book, which is Franchise Savvy, Six Strategies Pros Use to Pick Top Performing Franchises. What can you deduce from what we're just talking about that is described in your book? And who is your book primarily for?
So my book is primarily for people who are frustrated with their job and they want to, you know, be a business owner, or people that are downsized or laid off and don't want to go back to the corporate rat race. So it's really for new, you know, quote-unquote entrepreneurs or business owners. And it's really my story of how I went from a New York City subway conductor opening and closing doors in a New York City subway to owning my own franchise and building it and being really successful with it. And then getting into a second franchise and crashing it and losing a bunch of money, which is really how I became an expert. So you always lose, you always learn so much when you lose, you know.
Now, when did you first get into the franchise business?
Back in 2000, 16 years ago.
Okay, so I'm just wondering, from that time till now, has the franchise landscape changed? And one of the things that's being used a lot, of course, is social media. Does that change the way franchisees work or market their product?
You know, it's really, it depends on the franchise. And in franchising, there's really two sides of the coin for franchising. There's food, and then, you know, there's 90 different industries within the franchise umbrella. There's food, and then there's 89 other industries. So it depends on what you're talking about. Typically, when you're talking about franchising, you're referring to the food franchises. And things have become very different, and they follow trends on Yelp and Foursquare, for instance, which are apps that food fans or, you know, anybody could use to rate their food and talk about their food and give recommendations or, you know, trash a restaurant because they had a bad experience. Mm.
Now, getting back to McDonald's and their breakfasts, it's almost like McDonald's last year, and again, it's a year now that they've been doing all-day breakfast, at least in the United States. It's been a year that they've basically reinvented the wheel as far as for their business is concerned. Is that something that businesses have to continually do?
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the good reasons about being involved with a franchise, because they have the power and the money to do research and development to figure out what's coming next. You know, if you think about McDonald's, back in the 50s, it was, you know, 8 menu items, and now there's something like 183 menu items, you know, from salads to the breakfast to the fish to the coffee and all that stuff. So you always have to reinvent yourself. If you think about it, just about any brand that's been around for more than a generation had to redo their logos and redo the way they do business and retrain their employees and do customer service training and all that kind of stuff.
So if you were one of the major competitors to McDonald's, now that they've been successful with this for a year, what would your next step be? Let's say you were Burger King.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because a lot of other organizations like Burger King and Wendy's, as an example, have tried breakfast to a very small success. And so it's been a challenge for them. McDonald's already had a foothold in breakfast here in the United States, especially. You know, people would always think about McDonald's for breakfast, but you wouldn't really think about, you know, Wendy's for breakfast or Taco Bell for breakfast. So it becomes a large marketing campaign, and you got to really think about the marketing spend that one has to put in order to get the recognition to make it top of mind to say, oh wow, I'm hungry and it's, you know, 8 a.m. Let's go to, you know, XYZ place. It's a tough battle to do that.
Interesting stuff indeed. Again, your book is Franchise Savvy, 6 Strategies Pros Use to Pick Top Performing Franchises. And people can find out more information by going to your website, tomscarter.com, correct?
That is absolutely right, Peter. I appreciate that.
I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, this is great. It was an honor to do it, and I love it. Just let me know if I can ever help out again.
Tom Scarta, author of Franchise Savvy, 6 Strategies Pros Use to Pick Top Performing Franchises. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0374, and you'll find links to Tom's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. How do you decide whether a person who wants to be a judge is worthy of your vote? For me, the decision is usually influenced by a milkshake. Let me explain. A few years ago, McDonald's was sued after a customer who spilled a milkshake in his lap while driving crashed into another car. Incredibly, the lawsuit claimed that McDonald's should have warned about drinking a milkshake while driving. That's right, I said a milkshake, not hot coffee. This crazy lawsuit was eventually dismissed, but it cost the restaurant a lot of money. Yet when the restaurant asked the judge to enforce the law against frivolous lawsuits by penalizing the person who sued them, the judge said no. He actually said the plaintiff shouldn't be penalized for being, quote, creative and imaginative. Let's be fair. If a judge is more concerned with creativity than personal responsibility, that's not a judge I want on the bench. And that's why I always ask a judge who wants my vote about spilled milkshakes. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is from the Big Apple, Peter Franklin.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program, talking about stuff that takes place in the New York City area from your cabin. One of the things I want to ask about, because we've talked for years and years and years, and you are known as the Gabby Cabby, so you're a great conversationalist. But you might be aware of the fact that some people, when they get into taxis, they don't really want to have a conversation. And some cabbies don't get that hint. What's it like for you when people get in the cab and they don't want to talk?
Well, first of all, I don't play the role of the Gabby Cabby. When somebody gets into my taxi, my yellow mobile conveyance lounge, I'm a cab driver. I don't start to talk to them unless they bring the subject up. And when they bring the subject up, I don't give them any shtick. I don't tell them jokes. I don't do a performance. I would just discuss it in a normal kind of situation, not be a wise guy like I am with you. Because after all, they want to go from point A to point B, and they're really not interested. They've had trouble at the office. Maybe they have trouble with their wife. So they don't need me being a wise guy. You, on the other hand, know that I'm kind of like a wise guy. You're nice listeners, know I'm a wise guy. So I can get away with murder with you people. But no, my advice to young cab drivers, and I teach a lot of them how to make the maximum amount of money. And those are the magic words, though. The idea is to make money, not to make friends, is to shut up and just drive. And one other thing, very quickly, the average New York City cab ride is maybe 10 minutes. So, you know, you can't get a whole life story in all of that. So, like I say, shut up and drive the cab.
Mm. So do you have any tips? I mean, it's great tips for cab drivers. Do you have any tips for passengers who might have a real-life Gabby Cabby on their hands?
Well, I mean, that's a different story. I mean, you know, if a guy is coming in from the airport and he wants to ask me a million questions about the city, that's fine. If he wants to ask me what he should do with his two girlfriends and his three wives, that's fine. But the conversation has to be started by the passenger. And then you got to keep it into certain bounds. By the way, I don't do all this conscientiously. This is just by instinct and having done it. So I don't say, oh, I better not talk to this guy, you know. Because invariably, you're going to say something wrong anyway. And I'll give you a classic example. My daughter, who of course is my favorite child, only kidding, I also love my two sons, got a PhD in history at the University of Oklahoma, which is in Norman, Oklahoma. Their arch rival that they hate is Oklahoma State, which is in Tulsa. And trying to be friendly with some passenger who said he was from Oklahoma, I said, hey, I know you people well. My daughter went to the University of Oklahoma and in Norman, and he said, oh, we hate them. So I thought, well, shouldn't have brought that subject up.
Fair enough. Well, let's bring up the subjects that are actually on your website at thegabby.com, your true tales. I understand that there's a certain situation when it comes to selling food on the streets, food vendors and their permits. What's the story there?
All right, you know, the original intent was very decent and honorable. If you were a veteran coming back from World War II, you could get a permit from the city of New York for $25 to sell food. And for that matter, you could do it for selling anything. I've been meaning to tell you that I want you to bring all the junk from your basement down to New York, and you and I will set up a table on the street and sell it. I mean, it's a great gimmick. It's a wonderful way, and it made it possible for people to make money. Well, it's gone completely out of hand because the original veterans who bought those permits for $25 have long since gone. They're being bought and sold by commercial people more as a business than as an individual. And if you wanted a permit now, you would have to go to somebody who already has one and buy it for $25,000. I mean, that's how much they've appreciated. So the city, to kind of put some controls back on the thing and put it within the range of normal human beings, is going to finally add more permits. That will dilute the market and bring the prices down. And we don't have any veterans returning from World War II, but it'll give the ordinary man an opportunity to make some money. Right now, if you want a permit to drive a cab, where we have the same situation, it's going to cost $1 million. I mean, give me a break. How is somebody going to get $1 million to buy a cab?
Absolutely. So aren't there a lot of food vendors? I mean, I know New York has a large population, but how many food vendors are out there?
Me and two other guys. No, I'm only kidding. It's impossible almost to count them. They say maybe 3,000-4,000, maybe 8,000. I mean, the city does have records, but the records are all messed up. But they are the only vendors that really have to have a permit. In other words, like I said to you before, you could bring all the junk from your basement, we could sell it. We're supposed to have a permit, but nobody cares. On the other hand, if you're selling food, the health department has to issue you a permit. And by the way, the food is really kind of safe because they sell today's food. They don't go home until it's gone. And in addition to that, you know that when you go into a restaurant, you don't get to see the kitchen. With a food vendor, you get to see his kitchen. And if it looks icky poo, you don't buy anything. So you really don't have to worry about buying food from somebody on the streets of New York.
Well, speaking about food that may or may not be safe, what's the story about people actually fishing off the Ocean Avenue footbridge in New York?
Well, I use that as an example. I mean, we have a lot of footbridges, we have a lot of fishermen, we have a lot of water. We're like a water baby. We really are, with boats and ships and the whole thing and fishing. Well, it's against the law in New York City to fish off our bridges. And the reason for that is that you're casting the fly or whatever you're doing. The hook is flying through the air. Sometimes it hits pedestrians on the bridge. Sometimes it hits a car on the bridge. So they are trying to really kind of get a little bit tougher. However, now that the summer is over, it's not going to be much of a problem until next summer. But I feel that there's going to be probably a lot of new strict laws put into effect to really say, hey, we said you can't fish from a bridge. You're not fishing from a bridge. And by the way, you notice how many by the ways I'm using tonight or today. That's something which is also safe. You can fish in our waters. All this Hollywood stuff about bodies floating in them and all of that, that's not true. And the reason our waters are so clean is if you look at a map of New York City, you see that we're really sitting in the ocean. So the East River is not a river. The Hudson River is not a river. These are estuaries. So you can fish in our waters and have a good time.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you have often said, I mean, I'm single, so this is not a problem for me, but you have often talked about your lovely wife and how happily married that you are. However, your former mayor says that everybody commits infidelity. So who's right here?
I think he's full of crap, to put it bluntly. And I think when they talk about it, everybody doesn't cheat on their wives. Everybody doesn't cheat on their income tax. Everybody doesn't cheat on the time clock. I think people, certain segments of our society, whether it be the media or movies, makes this, you know, kind of example when these guys go bad. No, I mean, I've lived a long time. I'm now 103. Seriously, I've met enough people in my lifetime, in civilian life, in the army. Most people are good. Most people are decent. And I'm not some crazy Pollyanna who's walking around saying, la, 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 everything's right. So when Giuliani says that most people do that, no, most people don't cheat on their wives. Most people don't cheat on their income tax.
You know, Well, I don't know if we ever talked about this. How did you feel about Mayor Giuliani when he was mayor of New York?
I would have been a friend of his, I think, and I would have said, Rudy, you're a great mayor. Stop taking credit for everything. He just took credit for everything that happened. And even today, people get into the cab and say, oh, I see your crime rate is so low because of Giuliani. Nah, that's not true. On the other hand, we had Mayor Koch, who used to walk around saying to people, how am I doing? How am I doing? Like he was insecure or something. Giuliani was a great mayor. Koch was a great mayor. But sometimes they have to shut up.
And before we let you go, sir, the one thing you always seem to share, because as you say, celebrities are here, there, and everywhere in New York City. Do you have a celebrity sighting for us this time around?
Yeah, I have his picture on the website, Gabby.com. It's that Mikhail fella, you know, the one that dances around?
Mikhail Baryshnikov.
I mean, he looks old. I mean, I'm not picking on him because I look old, and I guess eventually you'll look old. But I don't know. I just had a thought in my mind of him bouncing around the ballet store, a stage, as a 19-year-old or something or other.
Well,
he was just walking on the street, but if you look at the picture, he looks like an old guy.
Well, the man is 68. What do you want?
Well, yeah, I know, but you got an impression. It's like, how did Shirley Temple look when she was 68? You know, it's just certain people are supposed to be young and virile. Hmm. But at least he's alive, thank goodness.
I know he's in New York quite often. I believe he lives there.
He's one of the directors of the ballet, either the New York or the American Ballet. Always get it mixed up.
You have to thank Canada for having him. You know that.
Yes, I can, and I'm glad you brought that up because I have a new line that I use with Canadian passengers, and they seem to love it. Yeah, we thank you for everything. I know we're your obnoxious big brother, but we really love you. Nobody thinks of you as foreigners. Anyway, my new line with Canadians, which seems to get a laugh, is when they talk about your prime minister, I'll say, how's the kid doing?
You know, Mikhail Baryshnikov defected to Canada in 1974 before he went to the United States.
Well, he just wanted to try out freedom a little bit. He figured you had a nice deal, why not come to us?
He joined the Royal Winnipeg Ballet back then, and then he was in temporary seclusion with the National Ballet of Canada before he went to the States.
Well, that's good. See, I'm glad we're talking tonight. Look how much information I'm learning about Canada. Oh, Canada!
And people can learn more information about New York and all that you do by going to your website, which is www.gabby.com. They can also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. Thank you very much, sir, for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you for letting me chew the fat with you. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you before we get to that illustrious point. I also want to take a moment to talk a little bit about Alita hair care products from Beverly Hills. You know, many hair care products contain harmful ingredients that can do damage to your hair and scalp. At Alita Hair, their policy is to use only great natural ingredients without harmful chemicals. All Alita hair products are made in the U.S. and are not, I repeat, not tested on animals. They're safe, healthy, natural, and luxurious, but not at the usually high salon prices. Listeners to the Stuff File program, you have a special offer. Visit Alita Hair at their website, alitahair.com. That's ELITAHair.com. When you purchase Alita Hair products, use the promo code STUFF10, that's STUPH10, and you'll get a 10% discount. That promo code again is STUFF10, and you can also go to my website, to thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0374, and you'll find the promo code and link right near the bottom of the page. Okay, back to the stuff. A woman whose mother's ashes were stolen from her car fears an addict stole and ingested them, thinking they were drugs. Carolyn Parker of Brockton, Massachusetts, says the ashes were in a plastic bag inside a small white box in her glove compartment. They were taken from her, the car that she had was an unlocked Jeep, in Massachusetts on Monday. She said the thief took only the ashes, leaving behind her expensive sunglasses, $20 in change, and a gold chain hanging from her rearview mirror. Her mother died in July at the age of 71. Parker had the ashes in the vehicle so that she could spread them at her mother's favorite spots. She says it's mortifying to think that someone may have ingested the ashes. She's asking the thief to return them, no questions asked. Could you imagine tripping on a 71-year-old woman? What kind of buzz would that be, huh? Yeah. Anyway, you know where we are, folks. We're near the end of the program. You know what that means. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff I present, the Idiot of the Day.
Authorities say a mother who mailed drugs to her incarcerated daughter is now an inmate in the same Florida jail. Monroe County Sheriff spokesperson Becky Heron said in a news release that a deputy at the jail near Key West found the envelope and noticed it had a chemical smell. He opened the envelope and saw a substance inside. An incident report says the substance turned out to be buprenorphine, a synthetic opiate. Deputies arrested 55-year-old Nadine Carroll. Now Carroll is in the same jail as her daughter, 27-year-old Shannon Carroll. Records show Shannon Carroll was arrested September 15th on charges of driving with a suspended license, because they always have a suspended license, and possession of cocaine. Nadine Carroll is charged with smuggling contraband into jail. Now, why, oh why, would you think you could mail drugs to a jail for your inmate daughter and no one would think to check? One reason, and one reason only, besides the fact that you're a really bad parent, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0374. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0374. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, I always screw it up.